The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Supreme Court decisions cast a light on the Trump presidency.
And the White House is aware that they do get credit for Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh, for Justice Gorsuch.
Biden benefits from his time in the basement.
We don't know what the Biden agenda is.
We'll hear from the founder of Black Entertainment Television.
I think this whole idea of defund the police is a liberal knee-jerk action to an issue that they created, thinking it's going to be popular among black people.
And the cancel culture heats up.
When we are memory holding 20-year-old episodes of Golden Girls, you know that we are not making fine distinctions.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, subscribe to my YouTube channel, and let me invite you to join you by video. And, of course, follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt and this program at Town Hall Review. Across the country, citizens are celebrating the 4th of July, the founding of this great nation. But this year, the celebrations are muted. The country is struggling through a pandemic that threatens her health and civil unrest that threatens her soul. In some locations, the fireworks have been called off for fear that displays will encourage large gatherings and spread the deadly virus. In other parts of the country, the fireworks are a welcome reprieve from a nation torn apart by political and social division. And we are barely halfway through the year of 2020. The second half, which will include the presidential election in November, offers few clues it will be any easier than the first. But the country has been through worse, much, much worse. And the 4th of July celebrates a time when the outcome of a difficult stretch culminated in the formation of the greatest nation the world has ever seen. With all the bad news of the first 6 months of 2020, this week there is some good. Of particular importance, the Supreme Court's decision to allow religious schools to benefit from a tax credit program. It's a significant ruling, and one that religious conservatives especially should celebrate. I discussed the outcome with Washington Post reporter Robert Costa. I don't know if you've had a chance to read Montana versus Espinoza yet. The Chief Justice wrote the majority opinion 5-4. It's the most important case for religious conservatives in many years. And for homeschoolers and for parochial school advocates, it is the most important case. It would have gone the other way had Donald Trump not been elected, put Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on the court because it was four liberals voted against it. I don't think, I believe it may be a beltway understanding of the base that thinks that they are upset more with Roberts over the Louisiana case than they are happy with him over the Montana case. I believe it's the reverse. But if we go 3-for-3 on religious liberty, evangelical America, Catholic Orthodox America, they're going to know that Donald Trump is the one that is responsible for protecting their religious liberty.
Well, and the White House is aware that they do get credit for Justice Kavanaugh, for Justice Gorsuch. There is talk, Hugh, and I have it in my story, about a possible vacancy this summer. We've heard a lot about whether Justice Thomas will retire or not. But the name I keep hearing in my source world is Judge Amul Thapar, the federal judge in Kentucky, that he's seen as a favorite of Leader McConnell, and that if there is a narrow window, someone like him, if Thomas retires, could be moved this summer. And you think that this is already a political and culture war in this country? Just wait for a possible.
Oh, Robert, you should have called me. I don't report buzz much, but since you brought it up, the stronger rumor is that Justice Alito is going to quit. Justice Thomas will never quit. And that Justice Alito opens up the opportunity to put on Ray Kethledge again, or David Strauss, or Don Willett. That if indeed Justice Thomas were to retire, would be Amul Thapar. That one's a done deal if it's Justice Thomas and Amul Thapar.
Alito, huh? That's a great tip.
That is what my, you know what happens at this time of the year is that people begin working the refs. And I'm hardly a ref, but I got a column in the Washington Post. And so they start working me about you know, this person would be great if Alito quit, and this person would be great if Thomas quit. And everybody agrees with what you just said. If Thomas were to quit, if he were to say, look, I'm 72, I've done my share. The presidential election is more than 4 months away. Yet Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden remains mostly sequestered in a dungeon somewhere, kept at arm's length from a conveniently distracted public. And the strategy seems to be working, at least for the moment. Biden's polling numbers tend to do better the less voters hear from him. That's a bad sign in normal times, but perfect during a pandemic. Eventually, the theory holds, Biden will be forced to answer a few tough questions. Salem host Sebastian Gorka spoke with historian and columnist Victor Davis Hanson about the strategy to keep Biden hidden and Trump in the crosshairs.
This is the question I always find myself asking, that there's no central command and control, but there is a collective understanding that this is how you do things. There's no requirement for the DNC or some master strategist to say, okay, these are today's talking points, but because
I've seen them. I've had them. People have sent them to me, and that's when the right plays those clips you see on CNN and NPR where they have the exact same wording again and again. 4 days ago, it was the NASCAR noose and the Foucauldian exegesis that, well, maybe it happened, and then it was all over the news, and then maybe it didn't happen, but if it didn't happen, it could have happened, and if it could have happened, it just as well happened. And that was the narrative. And now the narrative, I just was looking at the news, and they're all parroting an inside source says that Donald Trump is in a state of abject depression, and he might not want to run, or he won't run again, et cetera, et cetera. So they send out these talking points, and they have mostly former Obama officials who coordinate this with the DNC. And what is lacking here, Sebastian, is we don't know what the Biden agenda is. There's no counter plan to the Trump agenda. Is it stop fracking? Is it the New Green Deal? Is it reparations? Is it tear down the wall? I don't know. But at some point, they're going to have to give us an agenda, I would hope. Or maybe they think they can. I think we're going to hear in a week or two that debates are passe. They don't need to be done. They're reality TV waste of time. And then we'll probably hear that we can have mail-in balloting without poll at polls. And we're going to have a Zoom campaign all the way to November. And then we're going to be told that Joe Biden is as fit as a fiddle. And then if he were to be elected all of a sudden in February, they're going to grab their forehead and say, my God, I had no idea he's not non-compos mentes, and we have to bring in his vice president. So I think everybody knows what they're doing. It's just a question of, does knowing what they're doing means it won't work? And I'm not sure. That's what's frustrating about it. Same thing with Antifa, the BLM movement. We all know what they're doing. We know that it thrives and is fueled by acquiescence and appeasement, and yet knowing that doesn't mean that they won't succeed. It requires intellectual courage to stand up and say no.
Well, we seem to be short of that courage on the right, at least when it comes to Capitol Hill. Professor, you end that article with a very interesting analogy or imagery. You talk about having a small twig and whining, or having a club and getting down to business. Explain that imagery that you write with regards to the president.
Well, the president is in a uniquely unusual position because for the first time in the history of our republic, it's not at all clear that if he were to issue a legitimate order to send federal troops in to quell a civilian disturbance, as other presidents have, I'm not sure that they would follow that order. We saw that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and we've seen what the retired people have called the president. And then we've never had a situation, on the other hand, where mayors, police chiefs, governors of blue states would not welcome the help, even though their own cities are out of control. So that frustrates the president. He says, I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. But he can't. And so he sounds tough, but his club is a twig. So he's got to do two things to correct that situation. One, talk more softly and quietly and more enigmatically, let the people guess what he means, and then have a huge club. And I think he's turned the corner now. He's unleashed Barr, and Barr is going to have 400, 500, 600 indictments. A lot of these people, Sebastian, are careerists. They may say they're revolutionaries, but they're not French Mackies up in the hills fighting. These are people that want to get their CVs, you know, pristine and don't want an indictment on them.
They're salary men. They want to keep their jobs.
Yeah. Right. Yes, they do. And then I think he can say that he's going to encourage federal attorneys to sue municipalities who violate the civil rights of people who don't have police protection or social services that they pay taxes for. I think he can say that there's a lot of places, like Lincoln said to the Confederate States on the verge of sedition. He said, you don't own Fort Sumter. You don't own that armory. You don't own that post office. Those are federal facilities. You don't own that statue if it's a federal place. You don't own, don't dare go in and try to change the name of Yosemite or something, or, you know, or don't tell me I have to lock down Yosemite National Park. It's a federal park. So he can make that point that there are federal places within state jurisdictions that the governors wrongly have tried to absorb. He can also cut off federal funds. He can say, if you're not going to enforce federal law, you're not going to get federal funds in certain areas. So there's a lot of things that would really, and then he doesn't have to really broadcast it so much. He can just say, we're going to take care of it. Just wait and see what happens. Because this election is going to be decided by swing voters in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and they are getting fed up.
Well, this is the question I wanted to ask you. So your article in American Greatness uses the phrase righteous rage of the voters. Is that, I understand that righteous rage when it comes to his base, the MAGA yeah. base, but for the apolitical, for the center, can they be energized by that soft use of a large club?
They just want it to go away, Sebastian, and there's two alternatives. They can delude themselves and say they're going to get into a fetal position and vote for Biden, thinking, why doesn't it just go all the way like a child? And they'll think Biden comes in and then the left won't attack their own and it'll all just go away and that's better than what it is now. Or Trump can reassure them, don't worry about it. You don't have to go into a fetal position. We're going to win. We're going to win big and they're never going to do this damn thing again. And then they'll rally to that. But they have their finger in the wind. They have no ideology, the swing voter. They just want to be assured that whatever side they choose is going to be ascendant. That happens in all these elections. And if they're getting very scared now. They don't want the idea of calling 9/11 getting a busy signal. They don't like going to the park and seeing a bunch of stone and bronze corpses on the ground. They don't like having their kids reeducated. They don't like tiptoeing around the office and worried about something they emailed 7 years ago, you know, an enemy bringing up. They don't want to ally with Trump if he's not going to be their savior. If they think, well, he just is angry or he talks about how he was maltreated or his rating, rather than do concrete things that give them reassurance they're going to win. And if he can do that, he can blow the election wide open.
Coming up.
I think this whole idea of defund the police is a liberal knee-jerk action to an issue that they created, thinking it's going to be popular among black people.
The founder of Black Entertainment Television, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Remember, if you want most of what I do on my radio show that endures, subscribe to my YouTube channel. The Town Hall Review is brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Americans are dealing with complex and deep-seated racial issues. Not everyone agrees on the severity of these issues, but few deny that there are troubling patterns that require attention. There is little agreement about how bad the issues are and what must be done, but there is agreement that something must be done about the most important of them. The lines are blurred. The separations are large. The emotions are high. Robert Johnson is co-founder of Black Entertainment Television. At 74 years old, he's watched America change dramatically over the decades. He spoke with Dan Prof on AM 970, The Answer, out of Chicago.
There was an interesting piece in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution the other day where the city council in Atlanta, after the Rashard Brooks shooting and killing at the hands of police, by 8-7, close, but 8-7, they voted against defunding the Atlanta police. And one of the city councilmen in Atlanta, a black gentleman, said, you know, I hear from residents as shootings have increased in the wake of that police-involved killing of Rashard Brooks. I hear from my residents and they say, we don't want the police to go away. We actually want more police in our neighborhoods. So the white inspired, the white left inspired purge, it's not only not helpful, it could potentially be harmful, couldn't it?
Well, Dan, absolutely, it could be harmful. This goes with what I was saying early on the Fox News report, that white Americans, before they act on behalf of black Americans, they should simply ask black Americans what they really want. And I think that shows respect. But to the point of police, if you were to take the police out of the community, you will increase crime significantly in the black community where there is a lot of crime for a lot of reasons, but the fact is there is crime. And this thought about so-called reimagining the police to send other people out to deal with crisis problems where they range from husband and wife disputes to mental illness and everything, that'll work until one of the sort of reimagined police get hurt or, heaven forbid, get killed because they couldn't control the situation. Or if they form a union which has all kinds of requirements and rules that they feel they need, that again puts us right back into the same place of police and the local elected officials not on the same page, even though they will argue they have a common goal. So no, I think this whole idea of defund the police is a liberal knee jerk action to an issue that they created, thinking it's going to be popular among black people. But like I said before, black people have their own idea of what's important to them.
And I love that as a foundation because it speaks to agency and, as you said, respect. And there's something else that is under address, too. One thing is what you're saying, telling black people what they want. The other thing is telling America who black people are. And I want to get your perspective on how you think, if you agree with me, that the media caricatures black Americans. It is either celebrities in music and athletics, or it is stories of crime in crime-infested neighborhoods. And in point of fact, there are very few people, white or black, in this country who commit crimes. The white violent crime rate is 0.12% of the white population. The black crime rate is 0.44% of the black population. So it's higher, but it's still a tiny fraction of the black American experience. Not all black Americans are living in ghettos. A lot are middle income families in the suburbs and the exurbs and everywhere else. And the media presentation is you're either a celebrity who needs to be a social activist, or you're somebody who is a dependent of the state or living or trapped in a crime ridden neighborhood or had a death of a family through violence. And there's nothing in between. And I think it provides a complete misunderstanding of what's happening in black America.
Well, Dan, I think you're right that white America has always had a somewhat stigmatized vision of black America, and that has found itself and been portrayed in the media because the media is a reflection of the people who run the media and the people who watch the media. And so they tend to reinforce each other by giving people what they think they know is of interest and what the people who watch it believe to be of interest. But having said that, there is a definite disparity in the equality of black life and white life in America, and we shouldn't ignore that so that we can be equal in what is part of the American dream, which is access to capital, access to wealth, and their access for the ability to care for your family, build a nice home, build a stable community, take care of your health, and all the other things that go with having the income to do so. So We can't overlook that. There clearly is sort of stereotypes in the way blacks are perceived, and then based on a sort of an unconscious bias about how blacks are depicted. But the fact is, there are some real serious divergence in things like income, housing, education, and the like.
Monuments and statues have come under fire through the strife of the past 6 weeks. Even Mount Rushmore is in the crosshairs. There are a number of figures in our nation past who do not deserve the honor that they have been given, and some make no sense as targets at all. I discuss both with columnist Jonah Goldberg. If you're a northerner like I am, I'm from Lake Erie, you're not really aware growing up of the Confederacy stuff in the South. And indeed, the whole idea that these bases were named for Confederate generals really never hit me until recently. I just drove past Fort A.P. Hill and I realized, my God, he was trying to destroy the Union. That guy would have killed Lincoln in 5 seconds. Why do we have a single base? But if you adopt a good rule and then apply the rule, that's the way to do it. And the rule ought to be, we don't celebrate stone cold races, especially those of the 20th century, even those of the Confederacy. We are more forgiving of stone cold racists of the 18th century because that racism goes back in time as far as the millenniums go. And it Jefferson and Washington put us on the path, the Declaration of Independence, to getting rid of racism and slavery. But Wilson is a 20th century racist. He should go. And the carrier, the Stennis, that should be renamed, and I know this is being discussed in the White House as well, the Frederick Douglass. Would you approve of something like that, Jonah, even though we are in a moral panic, because John Stennis was a stone-cold racist?
Yeah, I would approve of something like that. I am wholeheartedly in favor of making meaningful distinctions, and one of the reasons why it's such a crazy moment, look, when we are memory-holding 20-year-old episodes of Golden Girls, you know that we are not making fine distinctions.
True.
And, but yes, no, absolutely. You know, it's like with the statues. There were statues that were put up in the 1960s as a middle finger to the civil rights movement after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, where they start celebrating, you know, these Confederates as a way to signal that they're not going to go along with this stuff. That stuff should go. I mean, it should go in a process. It shouldn't be torn down. It should, none of that stuff. But those things should go.
Coming up, more on the destruction of U.S. monuments.
Part of it is just a simple ignorance of history when you're pulling down U.S. Grant's statue, for example, and other abolitionists.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. As we discussed earlier, there are names in U.S. history that aren't worthy to be put on schools, federal buildings, street signs, etc. And yet none of us are without flaws, and some of those being attacked did great things for America but carry obvious deep flaws. Others, however, were great Americans who did great things in difficult times. Statues and memorials of Abraham Lincoln, for example, or of leading abolitionists who preceded him by decades and even centuries, for example, are among the long list of those that have been vandalized. Pete Peterson is dean of the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University. He discussed the need for historical context with Seth Liebson on AM 960 The Patriot in Phoenix, Arizona.
I'm worried about these really students that you're not teaching, that are not in your classrooms, that are not on your campus, that have gotten just the wrong message about this country, such that they want to tear not just down the parts that might have been artifacts and redolent of the Confederacy, but take down the statues of the people that fought the Confederacy. It's something else here, Pete. What's going on?
Well, it's a combination of factors, right,
yeah.
Seth? I mean, part of it is just a simple ignorance of history when you're pulling down U.S. Grant's statue, for example, and other abolitionists. That just shows a profound misunderstanding or ignorance of our own history, which is damning enough. The other part of it is the license that many feel that if they disagree with something, they can simply throw a rope around it and pull it down.
Right.
And that two-edged sword there, as you rightly point to, in many ways has been hatched on our college campuses, right? And
right.
It began when we started to conceive of this term that speech is violence.
Yes.
And the minute that we crossed that Rubicon, when things were being taught in our classes or speakers or so on, that the simple utterance of certain words or phrases or concepts could be construed as actual violence upon another person, to be determined by that other person.
Right.
By the way,
they get they are judge, jury. Yeah, mm-hmm.
That's right.
Right.
Exactly right. That was really the beginning of so many bad things. And I remember the piece 3 or 4 years ago by Victor Davis Hanson. I think it was in National Review when he talked about this college culture that is, or academic culture that's spilling out into the broader culture. And I think we're certainly seeing that today.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. There's a lot of things that have fed into this, that speech is violence. In some respects, I blame even some, not just our schools, I blame our courts, too, and our jurisprudence. Walter Burns, I don't know if you remember Walter Burns, a scholar at AEI for many years, former professor at Georgetown. One of the famed students of Leo Strauss, right? And he was talking way back in 1989 about that Supreme Court case, Texas v. Johnson, the flag-burning case. Mm-hmm. And he says it's a neat trick the Supreme Court has pulled here, because we all can read the First Amendment after the religion clauses and see that the founders, who were very skilled in the art of language, by the way, talked of freedom of speech. All of a sudden, the Supreme Court starts talking about what? Freedom of expression, which is not exactly the same as speech. So not only can speech be violence, but in cases like that, we have cases where violence is speech and was taught to be expression, at least, by way of speech. So I think
aren't we seeing that now, Seth? Aren't we seeing that now? I mean, when you heard some of these recent interviews with Governor Cuomo in New York about not addressing the violence that is happening against some of our memorials and statues. He basically said that that's just another form of expression that that needs to be allowed. And again, this whole concept of the person doing it being judge, jury, and executioner in this case of public monuments is really something that we need to confront.
Do you think that, see, so here's what I'm wrestling with, Pete. When I see the Antifa and BLM movements going after statues of Lincoln and Grant and Washington and Jefferson, I think, and I don't know the answer to this, I wonder what your thought is. Are they miseducated? Have they bought into the warped and wrong-headed view of what those gentlemen stood for? Or do they just not care and know it's America and America's foundations, and that's what has to go?
Unfortunately, this seems like a squirrely answer, Seth, but I think it's both.
Yeah, okay.
I really do think that there are people motivated by a simple ignorance of history. But actually, I think what's so damning about this, again, is that anything before yesterday needs to go.
To hear the entire conversation between Leibson and Peterson, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, a troubling trend.
These are girls who steep in social media. They watch the transgender gurus and influencers on the internet.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Wall Street Journal writer Abigail Schreier has covered gender issues for several publications. Her latest book is titled Irreversible Damage, on the vulnerability of young women to the latest push from activists. And true to form, Amazon refused to run ads promoting the book. But the book hit the market this week and quickly became a top seller. She sat in on the Dennis Prager Show.
And this is a question. This is not nearly as common among adolescent boys.
Well, so we have a nearly 100-year diagnostic history of gender dysphoria, and it was always little boys who began with it. The onset began in early childhood, ages 2 and 4. Little boys saying, "I don't want to be a boy. I'm a girl. Call me by a girl name. You know, I only want to play with girls." That sort of thing. So we know what gender dysphoria is. We have never seen it like this. So all of a sudden now, the dominant demographic is teenage girls. In the last decade, it came out of nowhere. And they really, what they exhibit, even though they call it gender dysphoria, it doesn't look like gender dysphoria. These are girls who steep in social media. They watch the transgender gurus and influencers on the internet, all kinds of social media, Instagram, Facebook, you know, TikTok, all of them. And they decide with their friends that they are trans. And the numbers are astonishing. We're talking about thousands of percentage point rise. In the last, 10 years in America, we've gone from 2 gender clinics in the country to well over 50. In between 2016 and 2017, the number of gender surgeries for natal females quadrupled.
If my daughter is 15 and says, "Dad, Mom, I want you to know I'm really a boy," can I legally take my daughter to a therapist to work it out and stay with a female identity, or is that against the law?
So this is part of the reason we have the problem, is that the co-opting of the medical professional organizations. So in, I think it's eight, we're up to 18 states now in the District of Columbia. There are laws banning so-called conversion therapy. Now, the conversion therapy that tried to reform or convert homosexuals was a very grisly thing, and it probably should be outlawed. But they inserted, very smart activists inserted gender identity language. So now therapists are not allowed to help a child get comfortable in their biological sex. Wherever these laws apply, they risk losing their licenses.
I had dinner with a gay man who's a Christian, totally acknowledged. That's why I knew he was honest. He acknowledged he's attracted to men to this day. But he said, "I'm a Christian. I want to lead a heterosexual life. If he wants to work that out with a therapist, I think even that should be legal."
Maybe it should be. But I think that the laws were ostensibly intended to prohibit the really, nasty and
I know you
electrical
shock therapy. Yes, exactly.
But instead, in the history of gender dysphoria, for decades and decades now, therapists have very successfully helped children,
right,
get comfortable in their biological sex.
By the way, in the DSM 4 or 5, whatever they're up to, the Manual of Psychiatric Diseases or Ailments or whatever the term is, is gender dysphoria even now listed?
It is, but it's certainly on. It seems to be on the way out. They've changed the name, so it's no longer gender identity disorder.
What is it called?
Gender dysphoria, and that de-emphasizes the psychopathology. So they certainly on the way.
How does the word dysphoria de-emphasize psychopathology?
The word disorder is no longer in the term. So even though it's in a diagnostic,
anytime you have dys, it's a bad sign. Dystopia is like the opposite of utopia. This is happening with more and more girls.
Yes.
And one of the reasons you wrote this really important book is to explain this to the best of your ability. So take it away. Why do you think this is happening?
So I think it's happening for a bunch of reasons. One of the most important reasons is that the girls today are in mental health crisis like we've never seen before. Suicidal ideation, self-harm, anxiety, these things are through the roof. They are for not only teens, but tweens, young before they're hit teenagers. So I guess, ages 9 to 12. We've never seen suicide among this population. Now we do. So we know these girls are in terrible distress, and we know that it's linked to social media, that these girls really torment themselves in the endless comparing that goes on, and these horrible feedback loops of feeling bad about themselves that social media really encourages and exacerbates.
Give me an example. I'm really not familiar.
So say you're a high school student or a middle school student and you feel bad about your body because it's changing so dramatically and you've put on some weight and you've got all this discomfort and you know, sort of alienation in your body, which is very normal for a young girl. So you might look at another girl when you were my age and say, wow, she's much prettier than I am. I think people like her way more than they do me. Well, now you simply go on to, say, Instagram, and you see just how much they like her more and just how much prettier she is because you see how many likes she gets. And in fact, if she goes out with friends and excludes you, it's not just something you're wondering about. Gosh, did they go to the mall without me? No, you see it on Instagram. Everybody knows they excluded you. And they may even comment on how you look. They'll post pictures of you. And they'll say how bad you look in your dress or how much weight you've put on or anything else. So we know that social media is incredibly cruel to girls. And because of, you know, all sorts of things in the culture that have allowed transgender identification to really rise in sort of cultural esteem and value, this is one thing that young girls have grabbed onto, they've latched onto as an explanation of what's wrong with them. Oh, it must be gender dysphoria. It's sort of in the culture now. That doesn't mean they're right, just like they weren't right about any of the past hysterias, demonic possession, all the, you know, multiple personality disorders. It doesn't mean they're correct in their self-diagnosis.
So if you're, are you saying that most of the teenage girls who that begin to identify as boys, it is a result of bad self-image induced by social media?
So social media is both the cause and the solution. So social media, we know that it's linked to a rise in, you know, mental health problems in teenage girls most dramatically. It makes all of us feel bad, but especially teenage girls. And it's also filled with transgender influencers, young teens who say the best thing that ever happened to me was when I started T or testosterone. All my social anxiety went away. It redistributed my fat. It got rid of my period. I feel great. That it's ridiculous, but the internet is very happy to furnish the answer that you're probably trans. And this very much goes hand in glove with what's going on in our school systems, which push gender ideology very hard.
Coming up.
No wonder being right wing is the new rock and roll on uni campuses. That's how you rebel these days.
The final segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, an abortion decision from the nation's highest court.
Even though he thought that decision was completely wrong, he now says, well, but once we make a decision, we have to stick with it.
A look at Associate Justice Clarence Thomas in dissent.
Our abortion precedents are grievously wrong and should be overruled.
A New York judge sends a clear message.
He issued an injunction blocking the governor's executive order that literally discriminated against houses of worship.
And amidst often violent unrest, hear from Victor Davis Hanson.
Who would ever have thought 6 weeks ago people might want to destroy Mount Rushmore?
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Hollywood used to celebrate the counterculture. They were rebels that inspired teenagers worldwide to go against the grain of society. But those rebels of the past are tame compared to mainstream Democratic Party activists today. Now conservatives are the counterculture, especially the faith-based conservatives who dare to believe in absolute morals. Salem host Mike Gallagher looks at a quote from a fictional reporter, Jonathan Pye. Gallagher was kind enough to bleep out the vulgarity.
I have been riveted by a video I saw last night online. I don't know who he is. He's described as a news reporter. His name is Jonathan Pye. He's a Brit. And sometimes the British have a very succinct way of cutting right to the chase, like this guy does.
Just what baffles me is this fashion for stifling language and opinion comes from the left. Liberals. Students saying you can't do this, you can't do that. Students are meant to be like Rick from The Young Ones, not Mary Whitehouse. All this youthful energy, concentrating on stopping debates rather than winning them. No wonder being right-wing is the new rock and roll on uni campuses. That's how you rebel these days. You vote Tory. Mental. Being a student used to be pound a pint down the union. Now, The NUS has raised alcohol prices to curb binge drinking. You've got students calling for statues of dead men to be torn to the ground because they were colonialists. I'm not being funny, but who wasn't? It's not an honour to have a statue in your image or a building in your name 100 years after your death. You're dead. It's no longer an honour. It's a reminder. They're reminders of how we got to where we are. Our history is being erased by students. Some of them history students. It's revision Orwellian. All for fear of causing offence. Literature. If you're offended by To Kill a Mockingbird because it uses language of its time that is no longer acceptable, if you can't make that distinction, then you're an idiot. And you have no appreciation of context. And you have no place to in literature degree. And yet certain unis, they're putting trigger warnings on these novels because they may cause offence. How many times do you hear that? This was edited, censored, banned because it may cause offence. I'm sorry, but no one has a right not to be offended, because offence, it's entirely subjective. It's no, I'll tell you what it is. It's utter, absolute wanky, cheap bollocks is what it is. Arrest me. Feel better now. Okay.
Yeah, I think we all feel a little better after listening to that. Rich Lowry writes a similar theme. Woke censorship is basically a superstitious cult, he says. We're living in a society right now gripped by a quasi-religious fervor, obsessed with symbols and irrational fears. Anything that's thought to have the slightest association with racism, no matter how attenuated the connection or how innocent the explanation, must be crushed.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. All the best to you and yours on this holiday weekend celebrating the birth of a great nation. Happy 4th of July. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.